Major funding for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities. From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center.
Well, every culture likes to have figures, books, ideas that seem to form that function of being the eternal verities, because that's a very powerful sort of concept. If you've got some eternal verities and I've just got some good ideas, then you've gained several cultural points over me, and that's what Shakespeare is used for.
William Shakespeare and the Politics of Culture, this week on Soundings. My guests are Jonathan Dollimore and Alan Sinfield of the University of Sussex. During a fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Jonathan Dollimore is working on a comparative study of sexuality and transgression. In the spring of 1989, Alan Sinfield is a visiting professor at the University of California at Berkeley. Jonathan Dollimore and Alan Sinfield are the editors of Political Shakespeare, New Essays in Cultural Materialism, published in 1985. Here is Alan Sinfield.
I think the way in which Shakespeare has been kept going as a cultural institution for hundreds of years is exactly due to people reinterpreting him all the time, and each generation makes their own Shakespeare, and that's how they get the eternal Shakespeare, by putting together that sequence of distinctive Shakespeares.
There's a commonplace, which is that every age reinterprets Shakespeare for itself. Mm-hmm. Now, that would suggest something which we would agree with, that in fact every age remakes Shakespeare in terms of its own cultural values. But of course that first commonplace is typically subsumed in a second, whereby we say that in fact all that's happening is that we are simply getting a local angle on the eternal verities, which enable us, with our limitations, to understand what Shakespeare already knew.
All right, and let me stop you for a moment. The word hour that you just used, the hour there, meaning what?
Both Alan and I participate in a cultural practice which is called cultural materialism.
And I recall from an earlier interview, you said something like, scratch me and I'm a Marxist.
I think I said, scratch me and I'm red.
Elaborate that for me. In what way does Marxism, for example, in what way do political ideologies furnish you with critical apparatuses, devices for figuring out what's going on in Shakespeare? Alan Sinfield?
I think the crucial point is what Jonathan just said, namely that there aren't any ideas that don't have a political implication. And when you look at the eternal verities that people have admired in Shakespeare, they tend to, for instance, propose very stereotypical notions of what women are supposed to be like and of what men are supposed to be like, particularly those things. And that instance is important because the women's movement has drawn attention, perhaps more than anything else, to the extent to which Shakespeare and other noted cultural resources do in fact have political implications. And if you have these comedies where there are women characters who go around behaving very boldly, but the necessary conclusion for the comedy is that they should marry a man and say the appropriate things which subordinate them to him, then that is some kind of political event. Now, you could say that it's ironic, but it's still political.
Are you telling me that Shakespeare was, in effect, an agent of this oppression, or he was himself a subversive? And you use the word, Alan Sinfield, ironic, that, for example, in The Merchant of Venice, Portia acts like a man, assumes the character of a man. Is that an ironic, ambiguous kind of expression, or was Shakespeare one of the villains that we need to uproot and say, aha, he's the guy who's doing the oppressing?
That's a big question, because there's two things. One is what you think Shakespeare was doing historically, and the other is what we make him do now. And mm-hmm. they obviously may not be the same thing at all. In his time, I think Shakespeare has to have been subject to most of the ideas about the world that his contemporaries were. Now, obviously, there was a fair deal of scope in that, and not everybody thought the same thing. And whether Shakespeare was on the more liberal or radical or subversive wing of things or not is still a matter to be discussed, I think, because we haven't really been talking about things in those terms for very many years yet, and there's mm-hmm. a lot of work to be done.
Jonathan
but
Palmer.
Also, you see, it's not a question of saying, yes, Shakespeare was a radical in the sense that he had an alternative political program, which he articulates in his plays. The point is that Shakespeare, while being contained, as it were, by those contemporary ideas, could interrogate them from inside. Uh-huh. He could represent them on the stage. He could represent the contesting points of view, oppositional cultures, without himself necessarily being designated a radical.
Is that why we call him a genius? Because he's capable of, or am I being, you know, wide-eyed using a word like that and apply? Or how, in fact, do you two think of him?
My description would make him sound more like a politician.
How and elaborate that description?
Well, precisely that he rather strategically represents on the stage a diverse range of viewpoints, uh-huh. and as it were, possibly undercuts one with another. Uh-huh. Now, whereas a traditional view might say, ah, yes, well, there we have the universal harmony, we would say that that process of uncutting creates a very real social and political instability.
Let me give you another specific, Jonathan Dollimore, Alan Sinfield, a recent guest on Soundings, the chairman of the National Endowment, no less than the chairman of the National Endowment for the Humanities, tells us that a play such as The Tempest, a line in the play, The Tempest, our lives are such stuff as dreams are made on, is in no way political. How, she asks, can that be politicized? Do you have an answer for that?
Well, one thing that I would make in relation to the claim that such passages or any passage transcends class, gender, race, is to come back polemically with the example of gender and say that it is perhaps in the area of gender, of looking at the masculinity, femininity, that traditional criticism has been most political in precisely the limited sense that it would accuse us of. And I would make this charge, that when you look at the way critics go on about the supposed virtue, female virtue, or indeed female vice, what you see is that traditional critics have been nothing more than moral hacks. Uh-huh. In other words, they've been reproducing the moral conservative commonplaces of their society, but dressed up with the academic respectability.
Well, what's wrong with that? Doesn't somebody have to come along and tell us, if not lay down the absolute law? We don't have God himself necessarily speaking to us in direct revelation. Somebody's got to give us some guidelines. What's wrong with that, Alan Sinfield?
Well, nothing. I think we should talk about what guidelines and rules we want to have and have discussions about them. And you can indeed have such discussions by talking about Shakespeare. Uh-huh. It's just that I wouldn't want to assume anything when we went in to the discussion. I wouldn't want to assume that necessarily any tablets were being brought down from the mountain.
I think
if you're going to keep the line about our revels now are ended and we are such dreams, then there should be a direct take-up of that, and we shouldn't appear to evade it.
Fair enough. What have you got in mind, Alan Sinfield?
I think the issue about that line is it does propose a certain idea of what human beings are like and of what the baseline is in human mm-hmm. interaction. And the baseline in human interaction is that in the long run, you're all dead and nothing counts. But that seems to be roughly what that line is saying.
Evanescence. That kind of thing.
Uh-huh. And the real truth is always fading and slipping away from you and something you're not going to reach. Now, I don't object to that as a way of talking about the world, but I think there are lots of other ways of talking about the world that are more important. Uh-huh. And there may well be a sense in which the world is slipping away from me, but there are other senses in which real material physical things are happening to me and to other people in the world today. Uh-huh. And I'd rather draw attention to those and say, oh, well, look, all those people being hungry, for instance, don't matter because it's all really a dream. For the people that are being hungry, it's not all really a dream. They're hungry.
Jonathan Dollimore.
I was just going to add to that, that the fact that that particular passage is extremely lyrical, it has a real lyrical beauty. The fact that it expresses a very conventional notion of transcendence, an equally conventional notion of dissolution. Mm-hmm. These things should not somehow petrify us into thinking that it is automatically profound in the sense of that word, which means that everything else is relatively unimportant.
Uh-huh.
Okay, the passage is fine. You know, it's not a matter of being against it. It's just a matter of not wanting to say that that is the superior wisdom.
That's right.
And that's the bit that will really guide you through the world, as opposed to the other more material, real considerations.
Isn't it interesting that it's at precisely that moment in relation to that lyrical beauty that one is asked, in a sense, to stop thinking?
Uh-huh.
Why is it that the most profound points are those where one is asked to surrender and to stop thinking?
To suspend your
to suspend
what critical,
critical
thinking. Well, let me ask you to follow these comments. Alan Sinfield, Jonathan Dollimore, you seem to me to be proposing a sort of pluralism here in the way we interpret the topic in front of us here is Shakespeare. I don't know that anybody would really quarrel with that. The rub seems to come in the fact that one group wants to use an interpretive device or apparatus somehow or other to gain ascension or power over another group, even as we speak. Are we talking about the academics? Are we talking about what's really in Shakespeare? Do you get my drift, Alan?
That's the way culture works. Culture is always under contest, and it's under contest because there is a contest for material goods as well, and that's the way culture proceeds, that different interest groups make their arguments and their points of view, and the more persuasive ones, or the ones that have more economic and political power, win out over the other ones. And this has been going on around Shakespeare. This was going on around Shakespeare in his lifetime.
Uh-huh.
But
Jonathan?
Also those people engaged in this battle who can pretend to a sublime indifference to politics are often the ones who are most institutionally powerful.
Mm-hmm. What about the effect of all of this on the teaching of Shakespeare, upon our undergraduates? You two are both Brits. You understand and participate in the British academic scene. We're speaking principally to an American audience. Does all of this have an effect on undergraduates? Is this really just, you know, angels on the heads of pins, academics fighting amongst themselves?
I think there is a difference here between Britain and the USA. Certainly English studies in Britain are more politicized, and Shakespeare particularly is an area of political contest for students as well as for university faculty. We would like to see that situation to develop more in this country as well.
All right, what about this? Alan Sinfield, before our taping, you said something like, our Shakespeare becomes particularly political in Great Britain. What did you have in mind?
Shakespeare stands for lots of things in Britain. He's up there with the royal family and the changing of the guard and the Tower of London and things as one of those institutions that represent the things that are left to Great Britain once it's not so great anymore in the world. And that's one of the reasons why such a lot hangs upon what you do with Shakespeare or don't do with Shakespeare. So he's a sort of key cultural figure in a way which is slightly different from in the United States or other countries. The effect on undergraduate teaching is to bring it back to life, as far as I can see.
Huh.
And there is a strong tradition in Britain anyway, which really you were alluding to when you were talking about touchstones of cultural value and so on, that culture and literature especially should be full of meaning and value and should contribute significantly to our understanding of the world. Now, the problem that had happened with Shakespeare and other literary studies is that they rather stopped doing that. And I think they stopped performing for the students the functions that they were claimed to be doing. They really didn't seem as wise and profound and to speak as directly to young people.
Can you give
as
me
they
a
have been reckoned to do. What spoke directly to young people was the rock music on the record
uh-huh.
sleeves, and that's really where they went to find their kind of personal investments and their gurus.
You're telling me that the decline of Shakespeare we can attribute, what, at least in part, to the rise of rock and roll?
No.
Jonathan?
The shift in attention from Shakespeare to rock and roll, to put it somewhat crudely, mm-hmm. is part of a much wider, complex social change. But let us focus that change. Why not focus that change in terms of students' relative disinterest in Shakespeare
mm-hmm.
and total obsession with rock and roll? Then we might say critical things about rock and roll and indeed defensive things about Shakespeare. But instead of throwing up our arms and talking about social decline and decay, as, for example, in this country, Alan Bloom might do,
right.
let us focus the discussion precisely in that shift and ask the students themselves what's happening.
All right, now,
we'll find the students more intelligent than people like Bloom.
And focus it in causal terms? You mean why the shift occurred or the effects of this,
yes,
of this shift?
Yes, why the shift occurred and the effects. For example, what about the thoroughly deadening effect of traditional literary criticism on the
mm-hmm.
minds of students?
Mm-hmm.
What about all those students who, year after year, demand that some kind of attention to politics and gender be taken account of, and yet are told that that is an ignorant way to proceed.
Mm-hmm. But what about the fact that it sounds to me, Jonathan Dollimore, you could be talking about what the cultural inheritors of the 60s. What about a bunch of spoiled kids who took something good and ruined it? Is that too reactionary to describe it in those terms?
Those kids can ruin Shakespeare. They can equally ruin rock and roll.
Alan Sinfield, Jonathan Dollimore, we're talking about Shakespeare, the interpretation of the Bard, the teaching of Shakespeare in American undergraduate courses. Let me ask you to shift the focus of your comments. We've been talking about political Shakespeare, the politicizing of Shakespeare. What about gender? That is a big issue these days as we look at any form of literary criticism. Jonathan Dollimore, one of the words that you use in your project here at the Humanities Center is the demonizing of this or that. I take it you've got Shakespeare in mind also.
Well, certainly. I said earlier that traditional critics are often hacks when it comes to the question of gender. And I mean by that they reproduce in a very unthinking way very conventional ideas about gender and their society. And I'm not just saying that we find them conventional, I'm saying that 10 years, 20 years later, they are embarrassed by what they have said. And of course, with the event of feminism, with the event of gay studies, we become so much more sophisticated in our understanding now that the changes are even more rapid.
What are we doing? Are we discovering homosexuality in Shakespeare, or in effect, are we taking a modern concern with what gays and gay lifestyles and imposing them on Shakespearean
studies?
We're doing
many things, but one thing we're doing very clearly that is, instead of facile generalizations about femininity or masculinity, we are showing the way that in Shakespeare's society, gender, sexuality was massively implicated in every other important domain. Class was related to gender. I mean, there was a conventional analogy at that time between the power of the prince over his subject and the man over his wife. I mean, we don't have to dig for this.
That's a biblical model.
Yes, but it's, I mean, a commonplace of the culture. And one of the things we would do, in fact, would be to go to the literature beyond Shakespeare and show how gender was constructed, and then see that, in fact, the plays themselves address precisely those issues. They take them apart. Sometimes they put them back together again, as in the conventional marriage at the end of the comedy.
Alan Sinfield, is that a good way? Is that a reliable and accurate way to use evidence, to bring evidence from outside of Shakespeare himself and apply it to the interpretation of one of our cultural institutions?
Insofar as we're bringing evidence from Shakespeare's own society, I don't see how else we're ever going to understand what's going on in a text, because nobody would understand our present conversation today if they didn't have lots of evidence from outside the studio, which they were going to use in order to reckon what we're on about. And it seems to me exactly the same goes for Shakespeare. The point about the way it works in the plays is relevant to what you were saying earlier, I think, about how far they may be subversive or liberal or radical or whatever it might be. And one way of thinking of that is to reckon that anybody who's going to write a play is going to have to try and do it about something that's interesting. In other words, about something that's difficult, something that's contentious, something that's around the awkward areas in your society, in your culture, the areas that aren't quite resolved, the areas that are difficult.
Let's try race, class, or gender.
That sounds like some of the tricky areas in most societies, most human societies that we know about. So it's altogether likely that Shakespeare is going to bring up those issues, that he's going to write stories, use stories that work on the borders of the acceptable. Now, one way of thinking about the fact that the female characters are played by males in those plays, and that the plays allude to that fact by having the female characters then dress up as boys, that draws attention to one of the boundaries around sexuality, namely the boundary of the masculine, the boundary of the feminine, and it plays around with that boundary. Now, it doesn't necessarily say anything definitive about it. It doesn't necessarily say, here is the homoerotic, this is what a woman really is like, this is how a man and a boy can really relate erotically in Twelfth Night, for instance. But certainly it alludes to those possibilities, and it plays with them.
So there was a partial truth in the way, as an undergraduate, I absorbed Shakespeare, that the explanation of men playing the part of women was simply a social convention. You're willing to take that at face value and then say, yes, but in addition to it, it reflects certain tensions and problems that existed in the sexuality of the Elizabethan society.
And
Jonathan?
It was something which the theatre consciously played with, because the theatre itself was often accused of violating gender, violating identity.
All right, now what are we to make of it today? What are we doing to those circumstances and the way we interpret them that adds... that amplifies our understanding of Shakespeare?
Well, we are rediscovering, if you like, what the theatre already knew, which is that gender identity is bound up, is just inseparable from other kinds of identity in society. And the theatre played with those because it was acutely aware. I mean, the fact that boys dressed up as women, but not only that, the fact that all actors dressed up in, as it were, forbidden identities, the identity of the prince, the ruler, the fact that they played with those identities in that sense of masquerade made them acutely aware in the theatre of the way the whole of society is, in a sense, a masquerade and not something God-given.
Mm-hmm. And let me put a question to you quite bluntly, Alan Sinfield, Jonathan Dollimore. Is what you are describing now, is this an apology for homosexuality in the 1980s, finding things in Shakespeare several hundred years ago that aren't necessarily there?
For some people, it might be an attempt to get homosexuality onto the agenda. I don't think one would want to feel obliged to apologize for anything. But the first thing you've got to do if you're going to engage in the contest for cultural authority, which I've talked about, is to get attention at all and to get a topic, as I say, on the agenda.
And this is the way to do it.
But yeah, I mean, but homosexuality is put on the agenda by those laws that exist against it and that people are still campaigning to introduce.
Let us add that there is now a movement within gender studies, a movement which is getting us to radically rethink the whole history of sexuality. Let us remember that the word homosexuality is a very recent one, and scholars from a wide range of areas are looking again at the Elizabethan Jacobean period and showing us that, in fact, the construction of sexuality was so different that it does not make sense to think of that period in our own conventional terms. So I don't think there's much point in saying, look, this character in Shakespeare is in fact a homosexual. Mm-hmm. What we've got to do is to analyze the whole structure of sexuality in the past, and then the political effect of that will be that we will then relativize our own obsessive preoccupations with, e.g., homosexuality.
What about race at the same time?
We've spoken about gender. I think race is equally important. Some of the most interesting recent studies have looked at the way that Shakespeare has been used in both South Africa and India quite directly in racist and colonialist forms of education. Now, I don't want to imply any simplistic view there that it is simply a case of co-opting Shakespeare to a racist perspective, but these books have explored the complexity of what is going on, and it has to be said, the bottom line is that Shakespeare there is incontestably put to extremely conservative political uses, and moreover, that the origin, as it were, of the Shakespeare South Africa, and even more of the Indian South Africa, are precisely in Britain.
It's a wonderful twist that, according to some statistics that I saw recently, the two, speaking of high and low culture, Alan Sinfield, Jonathan Dollimore, the two points of reference in South African society, the two most popular entertainments are Othello, on the one hand, and the Bill Cosby Show. on the other. Let's move toward a conclusion of our discussion. I want to challenge you with a phrase, again, that came up on a recent edition of Soundings. An art beyond or above politics. Is that really a non sequitur in terms of the way you, Jonathan Dollimore, Alan Sinfield, look at Shakespeare, the ways we interpret him?
The whole concept of art is itself a political concept in the first place. The whole idea of art as precisely what you said, namely something which is beyond politics, is a political conception. To claim that what you're doing is beyond politics is a very good way of claiming special authority for it. It's political.
Jonathan?
I would just add to that the notion that political criticism is not creative, I would totally reject that idea. We have a concept of political criticism which would make it as creative and sensitive, indeed more so, than anything which passed as traditional art divorced from politics.
All right, and a quick footnote to our conversation, Jonathan and Alan. I want you to name a character or a scene or a situation in Shakespeare. Why do you read him? What is it that you find rewarding, edifying? Why is it that you go back to this, fount of our dramatic wisdom?
I would not pick one scene or one character. I would say that what particularly interests me now in Shakespeare is his representation of marginal figures. Huh. The witches in Macbeth, the prostitutes in Measure for Measure. And the way that he explores marginality as itself an aspect of domination. It's not just that these people were controlled, it's that their representation in culture is a crucial aspect of dominant power.
Alan Sinfield, I'll give you the last word.
Well, I'll try and give you a scene, if you like, and that is the one where Shylock is in court in The Merchant of Venice, and where you could think, although it's the kind of play it is, it won't happen, but you could think that the underdog, Shylock, the Jew, is about to get his own back. All through the play, he's been put upon, they've been despising him and leaning on him, and now, just for a moment, it looks like he's got the upper hand, because he's got the bond in his hand, and the bond allows him to take the life of his enemy. And it looks as if he might just do it. You know, the person who's the outlaw, he might get his own back. Of course, it's not going to work because the Duke, the judge, is on the other side. The other side's got all the best lawyers. They've even got women lawyers who are better than men lawyers. The other side hold all the cards. They're all rich and clever and so on. And as the scene goes on, you see, after all, Shylock wasn't going to get there. Just the same as always, they get you. Nevertheless, he had his go, and you think, right on, Shylock, show him there. That's an interesting scene, I think.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to a discussion featuring Jonathan Dollimore and Alan Sinfield of the University of Sussex. Jonathan Dollimore is the author of Radical Tragedy, Religion, Ideology, and Power in the Drama of Shakespeare and His Contemporaries, published in 1984. Alan Sinfield's book, Literature, Politics, and Culture in Postwar Britain, is scheduled for publication next fall by the University of California Press. Soundings is available on cassette. Send $4 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Ask for program number 453. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. When writing, please mention the call letters of this radio station. Next week on Soundings, two conversations. My guests will be Lynn Hunt of the University of Pennsylvania and Larry Eugene Jones of Canisius College. Lynn Hunt will discuss gender and French revolutionary history. Larry Eugene Jones will discuss the German Reich and the Nazi seizure of power between 1928 and 1934. Soundings concludes now with Timeline, a weekly cultural retrospective. Early June marks an anniversary for the first successful flight of a hot air balloon. Co-inventors Joseph and Jacques Montgolfier launched their balloon for a 10-minute flight at Annonay, France, in early June 1783. William G. Wilson and Dr. Robert Smith founded Alcoholics Anonymous during the first week of June 1935 at Akron, Ohio. James Madison first proposed the American Bill of Rights 200 years ago in early June 1789. Finally, the American architect Frank Lloyd Wright, the Scottish philosopher and economist Adam Smith, and the American poet and author Gwendolyn Brooks have birthdays during the first week in June. Frank Lloyd Wright was born in 1867, Adam Smith in 1723, and Gwendolyn Brooks in 1917. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
William Shakespeare and the Politics of Culture, this week on Soundings. Listen for Jonathan Dollimore and Alan Sinfield of the University of Sussex. Jonathan Dollimore and Alan Sinfield are the editors of Political Shakespeare, published in 1985. How have past ages interpreted Shakespeare's work? To what ends is Shakespeare evaluated today? Shakespeare and the Politics of Culture, some answers and insights this week on Soundings.